You're listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit nakedbiblepodcast.com and click on the support link in the upper right-hand corner. If you're new to the podcast and Dr. Heiser's approach to the Bible, click on New Start Here at nakedbiblepodcast.com.
Welcome to the Naked Bible Podcast, episode 378, Revelation 10. I'm the layman, Trey Strickland, and he's the scholar, Dr. Michael Heiser. Hey, Mike, what's going on?
Hey, you know, what's going on? Well, I think it's better to say what almost went on.
Oh.
You know, I almost, no, it's not, you're thinking the beach. It's not that. Okay, so you're still safe with the under. All right.
Good deal.
But I almost went in our pool. And what I mean by that is the thought entered my mind. But then I got distracted.
I was going to say you like, might have like almost fell in.
No. I was like acting with intention. Like, oh, it's hot today. I think I'll go in the pool for the first time. But then I got distracted. I don't know. Maybe Drina gave me something to do, or I forgot something I was supposed to do. But I never got there. So it did enter my head, and it almost happened. So,
well, we need a new, you know,
that's
over
that's
under
like almost news
for the pool. We need a new over under for the pool. I'm going to go over under 5.5 that you get in the pool for the entire summer. That's the total.
Wow. That's ambitious. You know,
I figured over the entire summer.
And the beach is
summer.
What? The beach was what? Two?
No,
the beach
one and
was
a half.
Two over under is 1.5. Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. And the pool is right, 5.5.
Is Vegas going to hear about that? Is that what the angle is here?
I'm sure there's a sports book out there that listens to the show. Right. And if you're out there and you this on the board, let us know, because that would be, I don't know if that's troubling or cool at the same time. I don't know.
Yeah, I'd vote for troubling, but
I might vote for
anyway,
cool, Mike.
Something almost happened this week.
Well, breaking news. That's
yeah,
podcast
that's the best
worthy.
I can do. Yeah. Now, we have to get in fantasy football mode a little bit, because Tim Tebow did sign in Jacksonville. That was news in Jacksonville this week. So I'm just going to say it right now. I don't plan on picking him. Okay. But there you go.
But if he's there,
I'll let you pick him, Trey.
I'll take him. You kidding me? We need to get Tim on the show. That'd be... you need to work your magic. I know you got connections there, Mike, with Jaguars.
I know. He lives about 10 minutes from me. You know, well, it just...
Let's get him on the show.
You know, it's Tebow, so...
Let's get him on the show.
You know, we can't even get him into church, you know, because he's been at the church before, you know, and it's like... We actually had this discussion in the office. It's like, Tebow's going to retire from baseball, and so he's going to... You don't want to put up with spring training anymore. He's going to be home more, you know, like why, you know, because we have this TV channel thing, you know, at Awakening. And it's like, you know, surely he'd have something he'd want to talk about. And then like a week later, we hear this football news. It's like, well, there that goes, you know, and now he's going to be tied up with that. So I don't know, you know, maybe at some point we'd actually make some kind of connection. But yeah.
Does he go?
Yeah, if I could get him on the podcast, we would do that. No, I don't know where he goes. But it's not at Celebration, though.
All right. Well,
he has spoken there before in the past, probably like, I don't know, 15 years ago or something. But there are a few people who know him, and we got one guy on staff that, you know, played for the Jags too. So that would be an easy kind of contact to make. But
there
you know, maybe at some point.
Well, there you go, Tim. If you're listening, open invitation. There you go.
There you go. Open invitation.
My phone is turned on. All right, yeah, Mike.
Well, if he is listening, he, you know, might be offended that I just said I wouldn't pick him. So maybe I'll rethink that. I don't know.
No, it's too late. I got him.
It depends how the draft is looking.
All right, Mike. Well, we're almost halfway through Revelation. Almost. Just like you almost got in the pool.
That's right. Well, I'd say the chances are more secure that we'll finish Revelation and I'll get in the pool, but I don't know, you know, it just, the thought might reemerge in my head and again, the clouds may part and I might actually go in. So who knows?
Well, don't, audience, don't, we won't hold our breath.
That's good. That's good. That's good advice right there. Yeah, we're in Revelation 10 today. I actually did have that thought too. It's like, wow, we're like almost halfway. You know, and I think what probably made me think about it was Revelation 11, because, you know, we're going to be tackling that next time in the Revelation series, obviously, because we're going to do chapter 10 today. And I don't know how I'm going to do chapter 11, to be honest with you, because this is linked to the ending of the second novel, you know, in some sort of peripheral way. Now, there, you know, contest for the novel that involved, there was a riddle given. And most people, I word the riddle in such a way that they would think of Revelation 11, even though that's not the answer to the riddle. But it's like, how do I discuss Revelation 11 without, like, giving anything away? Because it's related to the answer. It's not the answer, but there's some relation. And I have to be careful not to trip myself up here. I'll figure something out. I don't want to telegraph anything. But so Revelation 10 today, let's just jump in. This is one of the shorter chapters. I'm going to read through the chapter, since it is short, and then we're going to pick our way through it. But to be honest with you, we're going to spend most of the time on the angel stuff early in the chapter, and a little bit on, you know, from verses 8 on, but the mighty angel coming down from heaven. So let's just jump in. Verse 1 begins with that line. Then I saw another mighty angel coming down from heaven, wrapped in a cloud with a rainbow over his head, and his face was like the sun, and his legs like pillars of fire. He had a little scroll open in his hand, and he set his right foot on the sea and his left foot on the land, and called out with a loud voice like a lion roaring. When he called out, the seven thunders sounded. And when the seven thunders had sounded, I was about to write, but I heard a voice from heaven saying, "Seal up what the seven thunders have said, and do not write it down." And the angel whom I saw standing on the sea and on the land raised his right hand to heaven and swore by him who lives forever and ever, who created heaven and what is in it, the earth and what is in it, and the sea and what is in it, that there would be no more delay, but in the days of the trumpet call to be sounded by the seventh angel, the mystery of God would be fulfilled, just as he announced to his servants, the prophets. Then the voice that I had heard from heaven spoke to me again, saying, "Go, take the scroll that is open in the hand of the angel who is standing on the sea and on the land." So I went to the angel and told him to give me the little scroll. And he said to me, "Take and eat it. It will make your stomach bitter, but in your mouth it will be sweet as honey." And I took the little scroll from the hand of the angel and ate it. It was sweet as honey in my mouth, but when I had eaten it, my stomach was made bitter. And I was told, "You must again prophesy. You must again prophesy about many peoples and nations and languages and kings." So that's Daniel, or not Daniel. We're going to actually get to Daniel 10 at one point. That's Revelation 10. Again, short. And again, we're going to spend most of our time today on this angel language. You know, we have here in the first verse another mighty angel coming down from heaven. And you look at the description: wrapped in a cloud with a rainbow over his head, and his face was like the sun, and his legs like pillars of fire. Now, all of those elements should sound familiar. The wrapped in a cloud part sort of sounds like Daniel 7, the Son of Man. But again, if you go back and look at Daniel 7, it's not precise. It's not exact. You know, the Son of Man in Daniel 7 comes with the clouds, or on the clouds, depending on how that you could translate that. He's not wrapped in a cloud, but again, there's this similarity to it. You have the rainbow over his head. Now, that sounds like Revelation 4, verse 3. Okay, so let me read that. Revelation 4, verse 3. Says as follows: "And he who sat there," the one seated on the throne in verse 2, "he who sat there had the appearance of jasper and carnelian, and around the throne was a rainbow that had the appearance of an emerald." Again, it just sounds a little bit like what we're reading in chapter 10, but here in Revelation 4, it's speaking of God. So you know, to this point, we've got one line that sort of sounds like the Son of Man, who is a deity figure. Again, those who have read Unseen Realm, you know the arguments that, that lie behind that, the cloud rider motif, used only of Yahweh in the Old Testament, the other four times it occurs. The fifth time it occurs, it's in this chapter, Daniel 7, and it's not used of the Ancient of Days, who's God, but it's used of the Son of Man, but it's a deity epithet. But again, you know, similar but not quite the same. Here we have rainbow over his head. That sounds like God from Revelation 4:3, the description there, but again, not quite exact. And if you recall, when we discussed Revelation 4:3, the rainbow description is found in the Old Testament in Ezekiel 1:28. This is the famous, you know, vision of Ezekiel in chapter 1, where you have God seated on the throne and you have this rainbow language. In Ezekiel 1:28, that's what John is picking up on in Revelation 4:3. But you know, it's God. So why? What's with the mighty angel here? Then you have another line, face like the sun. Again, this is very similar to Revelation 1:16. So let's look at that. Revelation 1:16, and this is describing. Let's just go back here. I turned to see, this is verse 12, I turned to see the voice that was speaking to me, and on turning I saw seven golden lampstands, and in the midst of the lampstands one like a son of man, so there you have that phrase, clothed with a long robe and with a golden sash around his chest. The hairs of his head were white like wool, like snow. His eyes were like a flame of fire. See, that, remember, this is the passage where we have Jesus described, you know, in Daniel 7 language. And it's not only the Son of Man stuff that you would expect, but the Ancient of Days description in Daniel 7 is transferred to Jesus here. John does both. Verse 15, his feet were like burnished bronze refined in a furnace, and his voice was like the roar of many waters. I mean, you have that in Revelation 10 as well, except it's like a lion. And here's the verse. In his right hand, he held seven stars. From his mouth came a sharp two-edged sword. His face was like the sun shining in full strength. So you get this face like the sun in Revelation 10 used of the mighty angel, you know, to describe the mighty angel. But back in Revelation 1:16, it's Jesus. And it's pretty precise in this case. And it harkens back to Matthew 17:2, the transfiguration of Jesus. You get the same kind of language. You know, legs like pillars of fire, Revelation 1:14. Again, we just read that. It also used of Jesus. It's not precise in this case. Back in Revelation 14, it was his eyes are like flames of fire. But again, you get the notion that there's some relationship here. You get the eyes like fire as well in Revelation 2:8 and later in Revelation 19:12. So what in the world is going on here? We have a mighty angel described the ways that Jesus is described and the ways that God is described. So how do we reconcile Jesus and God, who are uncreated, you know, eternal beings, you know, the Godhead thing with a mighty angel getting described the same way? Now, I'm going to suggest, and this isn't new to me. This is, again, part of the whole discipline known as, you know, Jewish Christology or Jewish binitarian monotheism against the two powers stuff. But I'm going to suggest that this is a case of what scholars call angelomorphic Christology. That is, it is similar to John's earlier merging of certain Old Testament passages about the Son of Man, the Ancient of Days, to point to Jesus. Here, though, in this case, we're going to see John combine Old Testament theophany motifs that were used to describe three figures in the Old Testament. God, that's one. Second, the angel of Yahweh, angel of the Lord. That's number two. And number three, the divine man who is or is of greater authority than Gabriel and Michael in the book of Daniel. So those three figures, there's God, there's the angel of the Lord who is God. Again, it's the two Yahwehs thing. And then there's this character in Daniel, the divine man who is above Gabriel and Michael in the book of Daniel. He's never given a name. He's just described. Those three figures are described in certain ways that Revelation 10 uses. Okay, so this is what would be called, again, in scholarly parlance, angelomorphic Christology. I would argue that this figure in Revelation 10 is the second person of the Trinity appearing as a man. He is called an angel here because of the Old Testament angel of Yahweh motifs. Hence, again, this category in the study of Jewish Christology or Jewish binitarian monotheism, there's a category called angelomorphic Christology. Now, the point of the category, lest this be misunderstood, the point of the category is not that the risen Christ was an angel and therefore created. That is not the point in the academic discussion. It's not just me, but just generally in the academic discussion. That is not the point. Because this angel, it goes back to the angel of the Lord who is Yahweh. He's not created. So that would be an amateurish axe to grind sort of quote unquote mistake or intentional error designed to deny the deity of Christ. That's not what we're talking about here. And again, neither do, you know, academics that are into this. Rather, this language, angelomorphic Christology, is to associate the risen Christ with the angel who is God. That's why the category, you know, gets labeled the way it is. This is easy to get wrong, again, on the part of those who cannot or will not see the close association between Yahweh himself and his angel in the Old Testament. Once you discern the two Yahweh figures, again, go back to my book, The Unseen Realm. Once you have that in your head, you can parse this language here. So let's unpack it a little bit. Now, On writes of the description in the first few verses of Revelation 10. He talks about the mighty angel. He says, apparently, you know, when it says another, okay, let's go back to Revelation 10 just so that we can follow or track with what On is saying here briefly. Then I saw another mighty angel. That's the way chapter 10 opens. On says another here apparently refers to the only, you know, Angelos Ischyros, mighty angel mentioned earlier, that is in Revelation 5:2. Now Charles, again, Charles was a early 20th century scholar of Revelation and Enoch. Okay, his name's, you know, R.H. Charles. His name's going to be familiar to a lot of you. Charles speculated that Gabriel could be identified as the mighty angel. This was his take. Why? On says he does this since the Hebrew term Gibor, mighty one, can refer to Gabriel. Gibor, Gavriel, okay, it's the same consonants. Gabriel means mighty one of God. On continues, there is, however, no reason to suppose that the author had any particular angel in view, and I would agree with On's assessment there against Charles. He writes, this is a formal link between two text units that deal with scrolls. Bauckham argues that the unique role of this angel and the majestic way in which he is described suggests that he should be identified with the centrally significant revelatory angel of Revelation 1:1 and Revelation 22:16, because it is the scroll in Revelation 10 that contains the primary content of John's prophetic revelation. Okay, and then Bauckham has 3 points. One, God gave the revelation to Jesus Christ. That's Revelation 1:1. Who is the Lamb, and again, who received the scroll from the hand of the one seated on the throne. It's Revelation 5:7. Point number two, the revelation of Jesus Christ, Revelation 1:1, points to the Lamb who opened the scroll and revealed its contents. That's Revelation 6:1-8:1. And third point, he made it known by sending his angel to his servant, John, Revelation 1:1. That is, the angel brings the open scroll from heaven and gives it to John in Revelation 10:2-8. So what Bauckham is saying, that's the end of the On quote, but what Bauckham is saying here is that the revelation given to Jesus and Jesus being the Lamb and the Lamb opening the scroll and then, you know, the scroll getting handed to John, these things are interconnected in these passages. Now, the first two observations of Bauckham have the revelation given to Jesus, who is the Lamb. That's kind of obvious. So then Bauckham goes on to note, he made it known by sending his angel to his servant John. Now, that makes it sound like Jesus cannot be this angel. And again, I'm going to disagree. Because if the content of Revelation 1:1 is supposed to have Jesus play the role of God in the Old Testament, in effect, occupying the God slot in the two powers pattern of the Old Testament, then Jesus and the angel can be co-identified. And you can still do that. in the book of Revelation, you have the risen Christ again, you know, being portrayed in this way, and the angel language is used of him again to take the reader's mind back to the angel who is God in the Old Testament. That's the trajectory that I'm going to suggest. And again, this isn't unique to me. This is, again, something that gets discussed in the two powers discussion more broadly in New Testament scholarship. Now, by way of illustration, let's go back to Exodus 23. It's a familiar two powers passage. God says to Moses, "Behold, I send an angel before you to guard you on the way and bring you to the place that I have prepared. Pay careful attention to him and obey his voice. Do not rebel against him, for he will not pardon your transgressions, for my name is in him. But if you carefully obey his voice and do all that I say, then I will be an enemy to your enemies and an adversary to your adversaries." Here's verse 23. "When my angel goes before you," so on and so forth. So God is the sender. I send an angel. But yet the angel is referred to as my angel, who has God's name in him. He is God. So it's like God sending himself. Okay. You know, it's this kind of language because of the name theology. And again, if this is a strange discussion already to you, you need to go back and read Unseen Realm. I mean, I can't take podcast episodes to rehearse all of the information about the name theology and Exodus 23 and Genesis 48 and all these passages where you have two Yahweh figures, one invisible and transcendent, the other one visible, Yahweh coming in human form as a man, not incarnation, but in the form of a man in the Old Testament. And oftentimes that man is called the angel. He's also called the word. He's also called the name. He's also the one who rides the clouds. I mean, all these things are related. But God can send an angel and say, you know, this angel, my name is in him, so you better obey him. And the name is another way of referring to God himself. So God is basically saying, I'm in that angel. I'm sending him, but I'm in that angel. I'm sending like myself. You know, this is where you get this Godhead language in the Old Testament. God is the sender, but my angel, his angel, is also him because the name is in him. Now, let's take this back to Revelation 1. And Revelation 22, this is what Bauckham is referring to. Here's Revelation 1:1. The revelation of Jesus Christ, which God gave to him. Okay, God gave to him, to Jesus. And John's other writings make this clear. The Gospel of John, John 17:7-8, John 8:26, John 14:10. I mean, you have the same idea of God the Father giving revelation, you know, to Jesus the Son. Okay. The revelation of Jesus Christ, which God gave to him, i.e. Jesus, to show his servants the things that must soon take place. He, that is God, made it, the revelation, known. How? By sending his angel to his servant John. Do you see? You see how that parallels Exodus 23? So God is the sender. Okay, he's sending like the revelation, you know, to Jesus. And how does this work? You know, he's sending the revelation. And the revelation really, you know, either is Jesus, it's the work of Jesus, you know, more abstractly and these sorts of things. How does he make this revelation known to John? Well, he sends his angel. And if you read through Revelation 1, and when we get to Revelation 22, listen to what Jesus himself says. I, Jesus, have sent my angel to testify to you about these things for the churches. Here Jesus is in the God role sending his angel, whereas in Revelation 1:1, God is in that role sending Jesus, i.e. his angel. And you go back to Revelation 10, you've got this angel who's characterized four or five ways, the way God is and the way the angel of the Lord is, but he's nevertheless called an angel. He's also characterized the way Jesus is characterized by John early in Revelation, but he's called an angel. I mean, all of these things are sort of similar ways of expressing the same idea, and that idea can be summed up with two words, angelomorphic Christology. We're talking about Jesus, the risen Christ, okay, as a deity figure, but using angel terminology of him to specifically link him back to the Old Testament two powers idea of God sending an angel who really was God anyway. Again, it's a convoluted sort of thing, and this is why there's so much commentary on Revelation 1:1, on Revelation 22:16, on Revelation 10, the first few verses. Okay. On says, God is the ultimate source of revelation, and Christ, the agent of that revelation, transmits it to believers. Right, he does. But then in chapter 22, Jesus plays the God role, where he's sending an angel, you know, to testify to John. You know, like he again occupies, it's like the slots are interchangeable. And that's part of the, it's part of both the interpretive problem for us, because the language sounds so odd. But again, if we realize how God and the angel in the Old Testament were interchangeable, they're the same but different, okay? If we realize that, John is kind of doing the same sort of things here in the book of Revelation that Old Testament writers do with God and the angel, the two Yahwehs. How they're different, but yet they're the same. The same thing is happening here. And the reason we get angel language or things said about, you know, this figure in Revelation 10 called, you know, the mighty angel is because of this. Because this is John again using this language, using angel language of a being that he has earlier, you know, he describes this being in ways that he earlier described both God and Jesus, the Ancient of Days and the Son of Man. But nevertheless, he uses angel terminology here. The only way to sort of coherently unpack that is to have the two powers idea, the two Yahwehs idea. Okay, God and his angel both being God, but yet different, you know, persons. Again, this Godhead thinking back in the Old Testament. It's the only way you can unravel this and make some sense out of it. So this is what I'm suggesting, you know, that we have going on here. Now, the angel here is not named, and I agree with On that Charles should not assume that it's Gabriel. Because even if you go back into Daniel, which we're going to do here in a moment, Gabriel is not the highest authority. He is not an angel that gets described in deity terms. There is another unidentified man. Okay. Daniel actually uses the term man. Okay. There's another unidentified man in the heavens, the heavenlies, who is above Gabriel and Michael that gets described some of these ways. So I'm going to defer here to my angel's book. I'm going to read you some sections of my angel's book. This is, if you have the book, it's pages 72 and 73. And you'll see how Gabriel has a lesser status. There's something, someone, some man, heavenly man, who is above him and above Michael too. So in Daniel 8:15 through 26, a man comes to assist Daniel in understanding the vision that Daniel's having. Says this: When I, Daniel, had seen the vision, I sought to understand it, and behold, there stood before me one having the appearance of a man. And I heard a man's voice between the banks of the Ulai, this river, between the banks of this river. And the voice called, it called, Gabriel, make this man understand the vision. So this unidentified man is speaking to Gabriel. He's commanding Gabriel to help Daniel make sense of the vision. So he came near where I stood, and when he came, I was frightened and fell on my face, but he said to me, understand, O son of man, that the vision is for the time of the end. That's Daniel 8:15 through 17. Now the description of this assistance is the focus here, and its wording will prompt us to return to the phrase prince of the host used elsewhere in Daniel. We'll return to that. The man Daniel sees turns out to be, again, the man who comes to him, you know, is Gabriel, because Gabriel is commanded by this other man, you know, to explain things to Daniel. Okay, so this man that comes to Daniel is Gabriel, but Gabriel is commanded to speak to Daniel by the voice of another man, emanating from between the banks of the Ulai River, where Daniel had been overcome by the vision. Daniel 8:2. The unseen man is superior to Gabriel because he commands him. Gabriel appears to Daniel to interpret a subsequent vision in Daniel 9:20 through 23, and in Daniel 10, verses 4 through 6, and 9 through 21, The prophet Daniel once again sees a vision involving a glorious man clothed in linen, and it reads this. Okay, so here's some sections in Daniel 10. On the 24th day of the first month, as I was standing on the bank of the great river that is the Tigris, I lifted up my eyes and looked, and behold, a man clothed in linen with a belt of fine gold from Uphaz around his waist. Okay, the sash around the waist, we've already seen that in the book of Revelation. We've also seen what follows here. His body was like beryl, his face like the appearance of lightning, his eyes like flaming torches, his arms and legs like the gleam of burnished bronze, and the sound of his words like the sound of a multitude. Okay, all that you can find in Revelation 1, Revelation 10. Okay, Revelation 1, it's Jesus. Revelation 10, it's the mighty angel. So again, it's angelomorphic Christology. Here we have this mystery man again, and this is how the mystery man is described, the one who had commanded Gabriel. So back to Daniel 10, we read, "Then I heard the sound of his words, and as I heard the sound of his words, I fell on my face in deep sleep with my face to the ground. And behold, a hand touched me and set me trembling on my hands and knees. And he said to me, O Daniel, man greatly loved, understand the words that I speak to you and stand upright, for now I have been sent to you. And when he had spoken this word to me, I stood up trembling. Then he said to me, Fear not, Daniel, for from the first day that you set your heart to understand and humbled yourself before your God, your words have been heard. And I have come because of your words. The prince of the kingdom of Persia withstood me 21 days. But Michael, one of the chief princes, came to help me. For I was left there with the kings of Persia and came to you to understand what is to happen to your people in the latter days. For the vision is for days yet to come." Let me stop there. So this superior man, this man who is above Gabriel, and apparently, you know, above Michael, because Michael is assisting him, this man himself was sent, okay, by somebody. We don't read by who in Daniel 10, but the implication is God, okay? So God sending his, doesn't say angel in the passage, but you get the idea that, you know, God can send his angel and the angel can still be God. So you're getting that feel again in Daniel 10. We have a figure here that is above, you know, Michael and above Gabriel. Michael is one of the chief princes, but this figure is above the chief princes. Why? Because he's above Gabriel, and Gabriel again is one of the archangels too. You know, so again, we have a superior figure, just ontologically superior figure, who he himself gets sent again by, the implication is by God. But he can still be God because of Exodus 23 and some of these other passages, you know, in the Old Testament elsewhere. "When he had spoken to me according to these words," Daniel says, "I turned my face to the ground and I was mute. And behold, one in the likeness of the children of man touched my lips." So there's another figure in here. "Then I opened my mouth and spoke, and I said to him who stood before me, O my Lord, by reason of the vision, pains have come upon me, and I retain no strength. How can my Lord's servant talk with my Lord? For now no strength remains in me and no breath is left in me. Again, one having the appearance of a man touched me and strengthened me. And he said, O man greatly loved, fear not, peace be with you. Be strong and of good courage." Which is, again, interesting. There's where else that occurs in the Old Testament. I don't want a rabbit trail. "And as he spoke to me, I was strengthened and said, Let my Lord speak, for you have strengthened me. Then he said, Do you know why I have come to you? But now I will return to fight against the prince of Persia. And when I go, behold, the prince of Greece will come. But I will tell you what is inscribed in the book of truth. There is none who contends by my side against these except Michael, your prince." Hey, Michael's like the good guy, you know, he helps me. Again, Michael is the prince, you know, of Israel. But this figure is not Michael. He's referring to Michael. So we can't conflate these figures. And there are certain traditions that do that, like, you know, Seventh-day Adventism. They're clearly different. And Michael is one of the chief princes, like Gabriel is, but this guy commands chief princes. They're different people. They're different, you know, figures, okay? So to summarize some of the things to notice here about the exchange, first, this man, again, in either Daniel 8 or Daniel 10, he's not identified as Gabriel. Second, the speaking man was opposed by the prince of Persia and Greece. Third, the man is not only distinct from Gabriel, he's also not Michael, since he refers to Michael in the third person. Michael assisted this unidentified figure in his spiritual warfare against the prince of Persia. Fourth, The unidentified figure later touches Daniel to strengthen him, informing him in the first person, I will return to fight against the Prince of Persia, adding that he expects the Prince of Greece will also be part of the battle. And while the man is never identified by name in Daniel 10, it's clear he's neither Gabriel or Michael. Now we meet this man again in Daniel 12. Okay? So we have here, at that time shall arise Michael, the great prince who has charge of your people, and there shall be a time of trouble such as never has been since there was a nation till that time. But at that time your people shall be delivered, everyone whose name shall be found written in the book. Then I, Daniel, looked, and behold, two others stood, one on this bank of the stream and one on that bank of the stream. And someone said to the man clothed in linen. So there's the man clothed in linen again. Okay, it's not Michael, because Michael's getting talked about. Okay, someone said to the man clothed in linen who was above the waters, remember, above the Ulai and above the Tigris, okay, how long shall it be till the end of these wonders? So the man clothed in linen, again, takes us back to the initial appearance of this mysterious figure in Daniel 10:5 and even in Daniel 8. Who is this man? Now, I would argue, I'm referencing my book here, I would argue that this mystery man is to be identified as and with the Prince of the Host. He's the Prince who is above the whole heavenly host, okay? The Prince of the Host mentioned in Daniel 8:11. He is the one whom the magnified little horn opposed. Now, in this regard, I quote from an article by the author's last name is Bampfylde. I think you pronounce it Bamfield or something like that. It's a really good article on this whole issue. And he writes this: who then is this man? The author does not identify him with Gabriel, which he could easily have done. Daniel has already met Gabriel back in 8:16 and would have recognized him if there was a renewed acquaintanceship. If it was Gabriel, he would have known him. The man whom he sees in chapter 10 is to be identified with the one who had spoken to Gabriel and sent him to Daniel. And I heard a man's voice between the banks of the Ulai, and it called Gabriel, make this man understand the vision. The man whom Daniel sees in chapter 10, clothed in linen, is described again in 12:6 as the man clothed in linen who was above the waters of the stream. He is therefore the man whose voice Daniel heard coming from between the banks of the Ulai when he first saw Gabriel. It's the guy who's commanding Gabriel. Bamfield continues, the man is not Michael. Indeed, he appears to have a higher status than Michael, the patron of Israel, according to Daniel 10:21. This man seems not to be in charge of any particular nation, but supports those who are on, quote, his side, unquote. He is therefore to be identified with the Prince of the Host, Daniel 8:11. This Prince of the Host is not Michael, for although Michael is the patron of Israel and an archangel, he is not chief of the archangels, including, you know, here or including in intertestamental literature. You don't get that in Enoch. He has a whole list of Enoch verses where Michael's mentioned. He's not the chief of the archangels. Back to Bamfield. In the book of Daniel, there is no possibility that Michael might be the chief prince. He is known as one of the chief princes. Daniel 10:13, whereas the Prince of the Host is called the Prince of Princes, Daniel 8:25. The man described in Daniel 10:5 and 6 is certainly not one of the highest angels, a prince and a heavenly, let me read that over again, Bamfield, so I don't misquote him. The man described in 10:5 through 6 is certainly one of the highest angels, a prince and a heavenly military commander, but neither is he to be identified with Gabriel, for he addresses Gabriel himself. Okay, so we've got, again, this mystery figure who's a higher authority, and looks like the highest authority other than God, okay? Now, these observations are important in light of my earlier, you know, contention that I read to you, that the commander, the prince of Yahweh's host in Joshua 5:14 is, in fact, the angel of Yahweh. And again, for those of you who read Unseen Realm, you know what the arguments are here. You know, the captain of the Lord's host, the commander, it's the word is sar, it's prince. He's the prince of the host. Just like the guy in Daniel, the prince of princes, the prince of the host. And in Joshua 5:14, the key phrase is, you know, when Joshua has this conversation with, you know, the captain, the prince of the Lord's host, he's standing there with the drawn sword in his hand. Okay. That phrase in Hebrew, the Hebrew behind that phrase, occurs only two other places in the Hebrew Bible, and they are both the angel of the Lord. It's Numbers 22 and 1 Chronicles 20. Okay. You can read this in the angel's book or in Unseen Realm or whatever. So I'm arguing that, again, that this mystery figure is, in fact, the angel of the Lord who is God. He is but isn't. And that's why he has this status in the book of Daniel. Now, there remains one other point to make this case, this identification. In Daniel 8, the passage where the little horn is magnified, quote, even as great as the prince of the host, verse 11, and he rises up against the prince of princes in, you know, Daniel 8:25, that has an intriguing parallel elsewhere in Daniel. Since most scholars identify the little horn as Antiochus IV, and he's the Antichrist typological figure. And basically every view of the Antichrist has notes that this typology. The little horn is the king described in Daniel 11. Okay. When, you know, the king of the north and all this stuff. So here's how it works. In Daniel 8, 11, and 25, we have these two statements. The little horn became great, even as great as the prince of the host. And then that's followed by the king representing the little horn, quote, shall become great. Without warning, he shall destroy many, and he shall even rise up against the prince of princes, unquote. If you go over to Daniel 11, where the earthly figure, the earthly counterpart to the little horn figure is being talked about, here's what you read. And the king shall do as he wills. He shall exalt himself and magnify himself above every god, and shall speak astonishing things against the God of gods. He shall not pay attention to any other god, for he shall magnify himself above all. So in Daniel 8, the little horn vaunts himself against the prince of princes. In Daniel 11, this king, the earthly counterpart, vaunts himself against the God of gods. So the prince of princes equals the God of gods. And the only way that works is the two powers, the two Yahwehs idea. Okay, the angel of the Lord is the prince of the host, prince of princes, and he's also God. It's the only way this works. So these parallels, again, lead some scholars to suggest that these titles of Daniel 8:11 and 8:25, prince of the host, prince of princes, are epithets that refer to God himself. The parallels, Daniel 11, 36, and 37. And again, that makes good sense if the prince of the host, the prince of princes, is the angel of the Lord. The prince, English translations have the captain or commander of Yahweh's host in Joshua 5:14. And again, that figure there in Joshua 5 with the drawn sword in his hand, the phrase, the Hebrew phrase occurs only two other places, and it's definitely the angel of the Lord in both of those places. So, you know, Michael is not this guy, and he can't simultaneously be one of the chief princes and also the prince of princes. It doesn't work for Michael. You need a figure higher than Michael. Now, all of that, we take back to Revelation 10. What we're doing here is showing how you can have an angel described as deity in the Old Testament. You know, we have Exodus 23. You got the Daniel passages here. You've got Joshua 5. And again, if you've read Unseen Realm, you know about the other, you know, Genesis 31. There's one of these. Genesis 48. You know, in Genesis 31, I am the God. The angel says, I am the God of Bethel. I mean, like how clear is that? You know, in Genesis 48, Jacob's, you know, prayer, you know, for Joseph's kids. May the God who did this, may the God who did that. Third stanza, may the angel who XYZ, may he. Not they, may he bless the boys. I mean, you have this co-identification of God with his angel, the invisible, you know, God, and then the visible God is the angel. Two Yahwehs. That it happens elsewhere in the Old Testament, and what I'm suggesting here is when we hit this in Revelation 10, John's doing the same thing. So it's okay for him to use angel language to describe Jesus and even God. Okay, because he uses descriptions of Jesus and God that he's used earlier to describe both of them. Here, he's describing a mighty angel. It's okay. He's not confused because he knows the two Yahwehs paradigm in the Old Testament. So let's go to verse 5 in Revelation 10. What I've just said is not inconsistent with Revelation 10, 5 through 7. Here's what those verses say to remind you. And the angel whom I saw standing on the sea and on the land raised his right hand to heaven and swore by him who lives forever and ever, who created heaven and what is in it, and earth and what is in it, and the sea and what is in it, that there would be no more delay. But in the days of the trumpet call to be sounded by the seventh angel, the mystery of God would be fulfilled, just as he announced to his servants, the prophets. Now, that all that would mean is the angel who is Jesus, i.e. the angel who is God, because Jesus is God, okay, he swears by God as God the Father. He's, you know, he's lifting up his hand to God the Father and, you know, swearing this oath, or, you know, it's this gesture of communication, so on and so forth, because it's in the hand of God the Father earlier that the scroll was. The angel of verse 7 is an unidentified, again, you know, angel who was going to sound the seventh trumpet. But you have this particular angel, the mighty angel, who's described in deity of terms, lifting up his hand and making a vow, you know, swearing to, you know, to God himself. That's okay, because the second person of the Trinity, if you will, the angel of the Lord of the Old Testament, if you will, is the servant of God the Father. And there's no inconsistency here in terms of, you know, later Christology that we're going to get in the New Testament and other language. So it, again, let's just keep that straight. Verses 8 and 9, then the voice I had heard from heaven spoke to me again, saying, go, take the scroll that is open in the hand of the angel who is standing on the sea and on the land. So I went to the angel and told him to give me the little scroll. And he said, take it and eat it. It will make your stomach bitter, but in your mouth it will be sweet as honey. And I took the little scroll from the hand of the angel and ate it. And it was sweet as honey in my mouth. But when I had eaten it, my stomach was made bitter. And I was told, and this wraps up the chapter, you must again prophesy about many peoples and nations and languages and kings. Now, if you're familiar with the Old Testament, this ought to, again, you ought to know where this comes from, this eating the scroll language and having it taste like honey. Okay, this is right out of Ezekiel. All right, there are clear Old Testament antecedents to this scene where who's giving the angel in Ezekiel? God. Who's giving the scroll to John in Revelation 10? The angel. Is there a contradiction? No. This is another reason why the angel is described in deity terms. Okay, the angel who is Jesus. You know, it's angelomorphic Christology. It's Godhead language. Now, Beal and McDonough comment on these last few verses here about the scroll and eating the scroll. They say this: the precise reference for eating the scroll is clearly Ezekiel 2:8, all the way to Ezekiel 3:3, that whole section. Ezekiel is called to warn Israel about their impending doom if they do not repent of their unbelief and idolatry. He is to preach so that the nation will, quote, know that a prophet has been among them, unquote. But also he is told that Israel, quote, will not be willing to listen to his message, unquote, because the whole house of Israel has a hard forehead and a stiff neck. That whole thing is a quote. Therefore, his message is primarily one of judgment. And back in, you know, Ezekiel, it's a judgment message. This is explicitly emphasized by the description of the scroll. Quote, it was written on the front and back, and written on it were lamentations and mourning and woe. That's Ezekiel 2:10. However, there will be a remnant who will respond and repent in the book of Ezekiel. It's Ezekiel 3:20, Ezekiel 9:4-6, Ezekiel 14:21-23. The prophet's eating of the scroll signifies his identification with its message. The sweet taste of the scroll alludes to the life-sustaining attribute of God's word that empowers the prophet to carry out his task, and they reference here Deuteronomy 8:3, and to the positive and joyous effect that God's words have in instructing and guiding those who submit to them, for instance, Psalm 19:7-11. Although Ezekiel's task is a sober one, he takes pleasure in the message of woe because it is God's will, which is good and holy. However, he does not contemplate this pleasure for long, since he focuses on the overall purpose of his call to announce judgment. Although Ezekiel does not refer to the scroll as being bitter in his stomach, he does refer to the scroll's lamentations and mourning and woe. That's again Ezekiel 2:10. Which elicited in him a bitter response, Ezekiel 3:14, after he ate it. The bitterness is in response to either his grief over Israel's impending doom or his anger over their refusal to repent. Notable parallels are also found in Jeremiah 6:10-11, and especially Jeremiah 15:16-17, which reads, Your words were found and I ate them, and your words became for me a joy and delight of my heart. You filled me with anger, unquote. In context, the delight and anger of God's words that Jeremiah eats refer respectively to the prophet's own comfort and the judgment of his enemies. And interestingly enough, the Septuagint, they point out, Beal and McDonough point out, the Septuagint of Jeremiah, again in this passage, has instead of anger, and this is the Septuagint, the Masoretic text, traditional text, has you filled me with anger. The Septuagint has you filled me with pikria, which is a Greek word that means bitterness, which is the nominal form of the verb used in Revelation 10, 9, and 10. So I'll stop there with Beal and McDonough. There are clear connections back to Ezekiel and to Jeremiah about this language of, you know, Revelation 10 about the scroll. And the point to recognize as we wrap up here, the point to recognize is who gave Ezekiel the scroll? Who gave the words to Jeremiah? Whose words were they that he ate? And the answer to both of those is God. Who is giving the scroll to John in Revelation 10? The mighty angel. The mighty angel who is described the way Jesus is described earlier in the book of Revelation, and the mighty angel who is described the way God is described earlier in the book of Revelation and in the Old Testament, in the form of God the Father, and also, you know, God the Father in theophany, but also God as the angel of the Lord. So what we have here, again, I'm not going to pretend it's not a little difficult to wrap your mind around. And I've said in Unseen Realm and in other books, this, again, you know, if we were just in the Old Testament, this is where Trinitarian thinking comes in. I mean, the Spirit gets looped into this matrix of ideas here in other passages, not in this one or the Daniel passages. But the Spirit will get talked about in the same angel and God language in other passages in the Old Testament. This is the pool, these kind of passages where you have two figures, and if the Spirit's looped in, then you have three, that are different, but yet they get talked about in the same way, okay, as deity, as God. This is actually where Godhead thinking originates and comes from, and hence where Trinitarian theology really comes from. It's not really the formulaic expressions Father, Son, and Holy Ghost, like in the Great Commission or something like that. I mean, those presume the idea. But as far as the theology of the idea, it is not something that just pops into existence in the New Testament. It has deep Old Testament roots. And again, if you've read Unseen Realm, if you, you know, maybe watched, you know, my Two Powers presentation on YouTube, you will also know that Second Temple Jewish texts do the same thing. You will also know about Alan Siegel's book, 1977 book. It was a seminal work at the time, called The Two Powers in Heaven. What Siegel had, he was a professor of Judaic studies and rabbinic studies. He passed away a few years ago, but he had a simple question. Since all these Jewish texts in the Second Temple period, you know, we have a number of Jewish texts that speak of two Yahweh figures, or will identify Yahweh as a man or this angel while still being Yahweh invisible. When did Judaism lose this theology? Because it's not taught. It's not taught today. And Siegel, again, his work basically established that this is an example of a point of Jewish doctrine that was later declared a heresy by Jews, by Jewish religious authorities in the second century AD. Okay, that's what Siegel's book is about. He's not an evangelical Christian. He was a Jew, and a serious one, and a well-known rabbinic scholar. Again, you probably also know about Daniel Boyerin's work in this area. Maybe Benjamin Sommer, The Bodies of God, how in the ancient Near East, you can have God be more than one person at the same time. You can have a deity be different deities, but the same deity at the same time. Again, this is not what we think of as Trinitarian thinking is not invented by a bunch of crazy Jesus followers in the first few centuries of what we call the early church. It is much older than that. And it's not isolated to the, again, the followers of Jesus. You get it in Judaism. You get it in the Old Testament. And even the wider ancient world at least has the category of this kind of talk. So that's Revelation 10. Again, the angel, the mighty angel in the little scroll. So next time we're going to hit Revelation 11, which I've already, you know, said a few things about. You know, that'll probably take us two episodes in Revelation 11. I don't know. That's just a guess. But we will hit Revelation 11 next time with the two witnesses. And along the way in that chapter, we'll finally hit the seventh trumpet as well.
Yeah, I encourage everybody to go watch your Two Powers in Heaven YouTube video. And that's probably one of the first. That's an old one, Mike. You did that a long time ago, didn't you?
Yeah, it is. Yeah, I mean, the first one, boy, that it's got to be more. It's got to be 10 years or yeah. more. You yeah. know, I mean, I've done that talk since, but you can still find the original one at... It was at a Messianic congregation, actually, in Washington, where I did that for the first time on video.
And then what was the reception of that when you did it?
Oh, they really enjoyed it. You know, they thought it was wonderful. They had not heard of Siegel or the Two Powers idea. You know, they were believers in Jesus, obviously, because it's a Messianic congregation, but they didn't know the backstory, you know, to a lot of it. So they really liked it.
All right, good stuff. All right, Mike. Well, we're going to be taking a break from Revelation, and we're going to have actually an interview. I believe Mike Bird is next on deck, and then a Q&A, and then we'll get into chapter 11 for Revelation. So looking forward to that interview. And with that, Mike, I want to thank you, everybody, for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. God bless.
Thanks for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit www.nakedbibleblog.com. To learn more about Dr. Heiser's other websites and blogs, go to www.drmsh.com.